Welcome to Thinking Aloud, a podcast about the nexus of politics and all those things that make us human. From the Lindenwood University College of Arts and Humanities, I'm your host, Don Heidenreich. Who owns history? It has been said that the winners write history, but it has also been noted that in the United States history, the North won the Civil War on the battlefield, but lost the battle for the memory of the Civil War. This has had numerous implications for U.S. society, both culturally and politically, not just in the 19th and 20th centuries, but into the modern day. To help us understand how this happened and the impacts of historical memory, my guest today is Dr. Jeff Smith. Dr. Smith is a senior professor of history at Lindenwood University, and he's on the editorial board of Radical Death Studies Collective. He's also the author of Rural Cemeteries Movement, Places of Paradox, 19th Century America. He's also authored a chapter on the contours of servitude and slavery in St. Louis in Till Death Do Us Part, American Ethnic Cemeteries as Borders Uncrossed,
and a chapter on Confederate monuments in cemeteries in the forthcoming book, Monuments and Memory, Examining War Memorials.
Thank you for being here, Dr. Smith.
Thank you for having me.
The big question I think we want to start with is, how did we get here? How did this start? How did the South end up winning the war for the memory?
Well, by design is the short answer, I suppose. And it starts even before the war is officially over. There's this real effort to recraft what the war is about. I mean, here's the problem for these Confederates. They look at it and they have fought this war for what they may have perceived as a glorious cause. In fact, they are fighting it for a social structure that is standing squarely on the foundation of enslavement. And they realize that, how do we rationalize and justify that loss of life and property? How do we deal with that? And how do those who are still alive deal with the loss of husbands, brothers, sons? And as they look at that, how do they do so? And so they start crafting a new kind of an ideology. And it starts almost immediately. And it starts out with women who are interested in sort of memorializing those dead. And they're going to be creating burial sites. They're going to be moving bodies and consolidating them. I mean, there are a lot of people who are getting dug up and moved, quite honestly. And as they are doing so and commemorating those things, it's one of the commemorations and ways of talking about the war that they can get away with under the watch of the federal troops and federal authority after the war. And so they're crafting it into what we often call the ideology of the lost cause. It comes out of an 1866 book that comes out about, called The Lost Cause, this great moment in American history in which they had fought for the principles of the founding fathers, and it was ultimately a lost cause. And the real problem is that it denies even a historical record that's only 4 years old, much less what's previous. And how that gets crafted is where we're going to end up. They may have lost the war, but they win the peace, ultimately.
The question, I think, becomes, why does that happen? What does the North actually complicit, or does the North just simply not pay attention to what's happening?
I think they're paying attention, all right. They are complicit to a certain extent. During Reconstruction, commemoration of death and of the dead is one of the things federal authorities are not getting in the way of down South. So there are a lot of things that can kind of skirt by. Well, we're actually going to be commemorating our fallen soldiers. Well, what we're really doing is bringing all these former Confederates into a cemetery, and we might even call it a Confederate cemetery, but it really is about commemorating the dead and this sacred function. I mean, we as a society see commemorating and mourning the dead as a sacred function. Now, in this case, there's a secular side to it, to be certain. But they're going to be doing so in a way that the North kind of looks the other direction. And under Reconstruction, we start bringing these states back into the Union. And when they do, so-called redemption, the Southerners will call it, as federal troops withdraw from those states and they leave Southerners back in charge of the South again, then they're free to do and say whatever they wish. And that is to craft a narrative that speaks to an idea and an ideal about defending democracy, about defending a way of life, about defending what they saw as a natural order of things. You and I would call it profound racism, but they saw it as a natural order. And how they go about developing that, strengthening it. In fact, in the 1880s, some Northerners are willing to kind of look the other way because that South is held solidly by the Democratic Party. And the Grover-Cleveland administrations both are going to say, well, how can we work with these folks and how can we work together? In fact, most of Cleveland's cabinet attends the dedication of a Confederate monument in Chicago because they, as Democrats, wanted to make sure that they looked like National Party team players.
So what are the tools that are being used by the South in order to push forward this message?
Well, one of the tools they're using is my field of cemeteries, burial. And not just burial, but monuments they're going to put there. And they will end up putting Confederate monuments in lots of places, town hall squares. They'll put them on courthouses and so forth and so on. Starting in the late 1880s, they'll have all those monuments on that memorial way in Richmond. The statue of Bobby Lee on a horse is still standing there. Might be covered with Black Lives Matter graffiti, but it's still standing there. And so all those symbols will be part of it. And the ones they put in cemeteries have a particular sort of message because of the way we perceive cemeteries, right? We think of them as sacred space. And so what goes on in there gets sanctified in our minds, like it or not. And so putting those particularly into existing cemeteries, the big ones are the most noted, Mount Olivet in Nashville and Oakland in Atlanta and so forth, that will have those. So they're going to be building those and they're going to build those monuments. And those monuments have a message. These are distinguished looking leaders. The great leader Bobby Lee on a horse, heroic Stonewall Jackson, stately Jefferson Davis. We look at all this and see how Jefferson Davis, what a great man. Well, at the end of the Civil War, he's not winning any popularity contests, even in the Confederacy. He'd been a pretty ineffective president, and Southerners generally knew it, but he gets recrafted. Another way they're going to do it is going to be through school textbooks. They create these organizations, Sons of Confederate Veterans and Ladies Memorial Associations and Daughters of the Confederacy and all these. And they will have what they will call history committees. And one of the things they are pushing for in the late 19th century and winning is the battle for the history textbooks. And this is, by the way, a battle that's still going on. This is how we end up with textbooks today that call enslaved people workers. They're not workers, they're enslaved people, which is a very different thing. So they will actually work to get control of that narrative. This is where we get phrases that you and I know so well. It's not a civil war. It's a war of the rebellion. It is about, the war is about states' rights. Oh, well, it's about different economic systems. Oh, it's about different social systems. And that's where these ideas are coming from, is from the lost cause. Now, I tell students, perhaps you do as well, say, yeah, I hear all those. But I'm reminded, they used to say in the Roman Empire that ultimately all roads led to Rome. Well, you know what? On the causes of the Civil War, all roads lead to slavery. And why are we worried about states' rights? Well, because we wanted to defend the institution of slavery and so on and so forth. So they want to get control of that narrative so that it doesn't look like we were there defending a system that is immoral, rather over these very lofty routes, and that what Jeff Davis and Bobby Lee are doing is no different than George Washington. And that becomes the narrative. And they will do so through those. They'll give speeches at Memorial Days. I mean, Memorial Days, they've got them up north, but boy, do they have them down south. On different dates, they'll have them on the anniversary of when Atlanta fell to the Union. They will have them on a particular birthday of a Confederate leader. So they're going to use those Memorial Days speeches as well, and the way they use those.
You mentioned initially that a lot of this started in cemeteries. How does it move out of the cemetery, though, the idea of the memorial? Because we think of, you know, statues and the recent discussions in the last couple of years that the idea that somehow or the other removing statues was removing our history. Is there really an equivalence there? How does this move from cemeteries to memorials to the whole question of being history?
Well, because it starts out with commemorating the dead, but the next easy step is from commemorating the dead and those dead bodies to commemorating commemorating what those dead stood for and fought for. And that allows them to get outside the confines of a burial space and get into the community at large. Once Reconstruction ends and the federal troops all go home, now they're free to do whatever they want. Once we've got Southerners running the South, we can do whatever we want to now. And they do whatever they want to now. And they say, well, gee, we could put statues other places too. We can put them in front of City Hall. We can put them at the county courthouse. We can put them in a local park. We can put those statues other places. And it's not just the statues. When they give those speeches, they're going to be printed in the newspaper. They are going to be published. There'll be little pamphlet kinds of things of Breckinridge's speech to commemorate that, that are going to be widely distributed. That message gets picked up even in the kinds of art that goes into people's homes. That famous Mishler painting, The Lost Cause, of the Confederate soldier who was coming home to the destroyed farm and the house half falling down. That is reproduced over and over and over and over again. And some of these ladies' memorial associations will even sell prints of that as a fundraiser, and you'll have newspapers encouraging people to go down and buy one. So we'll even see it in the artwork that's going to hang in people's homes as they do so. And as they bring those people together, not unlike the 4th of July.
Are there any particular organizations that really were at the forefront of this movement?
There were these local ladies' memorial associations, but in the 1880s and 90s, others emerged. Sons of Confederate Veterans, for example. The Daughters of the Confederacy is created in 1894. That's one of the things that they are dedicated to doing, is getting statues and monuments in communities, in reshaping textbooks, in getting the next generation to support this as well. So they've got children's auxiliaries. They still do, by the way. The Daughters still exist. They've got a headquarters in Richmond, and they still recruit young women to be members of it. Fairly recently, last time I looked, they even had on their website a picture of this year's new members, and they are teenage girls that are there. And they also do it through publications. Starting in 1894, they start publishing a monthly magazine called Confederate Veteran, widely distributed. I'll bet they're in a library in the country, didn't end up with one. The Missouri Historical Society has a complete run of it. I'm not condemning. I'm glad they have the historical record. Well, how did they get it? Did they subscribe? No, it just kind of... Because we want it to be lots of places. So what do? Well, let's just mail it out to them. You know, let's mail it to the public library in this town, that town, the other town, and every month. And being good librarians, they start collecting those as part of their collection. And the next thing you know, they've got 40 years of them.
Was there a particular geography that they were looking at? Was this a regional thing, or were they really aiming to maybe start regional and then ultimately have a wider impact nationally and maybe even globally?
What's so striking about it is we think of it as being regional, and it is in many ways. But there are chapters in states that had remained in the Union. Some cases, they were slave states like Missouri, Kentucky. In other cases, we'll see these monuments in other places, Chicago, New York, Pennsylvania, and in some cases where there are graves of Confederates that are prisoners of war. For example, there's one in my hometown of Columbus, Ohio. Now, you wouldn't think Central Ohio would be a hotbed of the Confederacy, and it's not. But Camp Chase is there. And the Camp Chase Cemetery is, in fact, there. And the Daughters, in fact, put a statue up. And it was vandalized in the midst of all this after what was happening in Charlottesville. So they are, in fact, doing so. The New York Times has a surprising amount of coverage looking at that. Also has a surprising amount of coverage of Jefferson Davis's funeral train when his remains were moved to Richmond, which was, again, part of the lost cause. So there is an effort to get that associated, and it plays right into Jim Crow. So those attitudes about race and about racial segregation and all the views about racial inferiority that go with that, they get folded right in. And so the Jim Crow North, they find that lost cause message to be not so unreasonable. It's like, sure, I'm willing to go along with that. And in fact, I think we still see that. those messages as well.
Interesting that you mentioned moving Jefferson Davis's body. How important was this both to the localities where this is happening and from, but also to the bigger message about the Confederacy and the efforts to rewrite the image of the Civil War?
It's not so much the death of Jefferson Davis, but it's the fact that his remains were relocated. When Davis died, he was in New Orleans, and he was buried in a cemetery there in a Confederate section. And he was scarcely cold before the negotiations began on the final resting place of Jefferson Davis, the president of the Confederacy. And Davis's wife and his daughter, Winnie, were the ones who were really making that decision. And the final decision ends up that they're going to have him buried in Richmond, the old Confederate capital. And rather than at the Museum of the Confederacy, they put him into an already established cemetery, a delightful rural cemetery movement, one called Hollywood Cemetery in Richmond. It is the one where James Monroe was reinterred. When John Tyler died during the Civil War, Hollywood buried him there for free. By the way, he is the only president of the United States whose coffin was draped in the flag of a foreign country. He was buried. His coffin was draped in a Confederate flag. Well, they moved Jefferson Davis there as well. And when they do so, it's a big deal. They move it, and it intentionally seeks to replicate or look like Lincoln's funeral train. And so the way the train is decorated, the way the car with the coffin is decorated, are reminiscent of it. And many of those same sorts of things. At the state line, the governor of one state, quote, hands off the train to the governor of the next. And there will be places where they stop and they take the mortal remains of the great man to the State House Rotunda or something like that, and people can file in and walk past the coffin. They put it back on the train. They go back again. I mean, they're going out of their way to make it look like Lincoln's. In fact, there's one photograph of this cortege in New Orleans going to the train, and the way it's taken from, I'll say, the third floor or so of a building, looking down on the street, the buildings on the side, all these people on the street watching it go by. If you put it next to the same photograph in New York City of Lincoln's, they look so much alike. And it's the picture we've all seen of Lincoln's funeral train, because often you'll see it with a little circle showing you where there is a 6 or 7 year old Theodore Roosevelt sitting on the second floor window watching it. So there's this conscious effort even to replicate the view showing all these mourners as Davis then is sent back. They raise a lot of money for that. Takes them 6 or 7 more years to raise enough money for the statue, which is in Hollywood Cemetery. And even there, they're trying to recraft the historical record. If you read what's on the sides of the base of that, this is a great man. To hear them tell it, this is a man who has devoted his life to the United States. He's been Secretary of War, and he's been a senator, and he's been that. And, oh, yes, he was president of the Confederate States of America. At no point does it say, yeah, and he lost, by the way. Every aspect crafts it. And Davis's burial and funeral train, I think, is a great example. I mean, I've often wondered about this funeral train. The record we don't have is that of these African Americans. This train's traveling through Mississippi and Alabama, and as it's going through, and those tracks go by, and those freedmen see it go by, one wonders what they are thinking and what's going through their mind when they see the body of Jefferson Davis go by. And that's what we don't know, but boy, do I wish we did.
Well, that would be very interesting. It's worth now taking a look at the bigger question of what was the long-term impact of this movement? How did it impact particularly Southern culture, but in the end, greater American culture?
Well, I think a number of ways. You know, when the 50th anniversary of the Civil War was commemorated, a number of these monuments were built, including here in St. Louis. There was one put in Forest Park. They just tore it down here a few years ago. It was removed. Much debate over what to do about them. And there was this ongoing debate about what do we do with those? And as we see those heroic views, what do we do with them down the road as our views about the war change and about them as that changes? And that's been the great controversy. And it has become a quote, liberal conservative, if you will, issue. But I don't think it needs to be. I think it has to do with, and it becomes partisan to a certain extent, because embracing that lost cause, some will say, well, we're embracing a conservative cause, but they're really not. And they really aren't, I don't think, very particularly conservative necessarily. And to say that conservatives support that, I don't think is necessarily true either. They will embrace that as they become a flashpoint as we debate the issue again about the cause of the Civil War. And if you take the position, rightly, I think, you've studied these declarations of secession, the Articles of Secession. You've studied those at length, so you can speak to this with greater authority than I, what they say in there. And there's this real difference even about the way Southerners talk about the cause of the war in 1861 and the way they talk about it in 1865. As we pick up the 1865 version, they say, well, those monuments are part of our history. Yeah, they are. But what's so striking is how many monuments we have to the losers. Robin Williams remarked when he went through Richmond that he'd never seen so monuments to the guys who came in second in all his life. And so it is. And so are they part of our history? Well, yes, but is this the way to articulate that history? And is it a complete history? And the answer is, I think, no, it's an incomplete history.
Do we see this as being more of a flashpoint and getting more use as far as the memory aspect when we finally get to the 1950s and 60s and the Civil Rights Movement actually heightens the, I don't want to say push for, but the intensity of this discussion?
Well, it certainly does. It certainly brings up the pushback. We don't start seeing Confederate flags being used prominently during the 50th anniversary of the Civil War, but then we don't start seeing them again until the late 50s as part of a pushback, particularly after the Brown versus Topeka Board decision in 1954, which desegregates. Chief Justice says that, you know, at least in education, segregation has no place. So the pushback against that harkens back to this heroic day, this greater moment, this lost cause of patriotism when Robert Lee and George Washington were one and the same. And so, yeah, I think the Civil Rights Movement does certainly gives rise to this. And we've seen this in the last few years, that part of the pushback against Black Lives Matter has been, in some cases, embracing those Confederate monuments. You know, there was an exhibit a couple of years ago at Philadelphia. It was an art textile exhibit recreating the Appomattox surrender flag, which was a white towel. And it's a weaving project that's pretty interesting. And one of the striking things when I saw it, big red, not fire engine red, but a cranberry red wall with the title on it. And all the way down at the bottom in the corner, in written in white, they tell you what color it is. And I thought, well, I've never seen that before. And I kind of looked down there and it says Benjamin Moore paint, color number, whatever it is, XYZ123, Confederate red. 2 years ago, 2019. Benjamin Moore, and by the way, what I found out, it's not just Benjamin Moore. I don't want to pick on them. Benjamin Moore is selling a color called Confederate Red. Most major paint manufacturers in these United States have a color, Confederate Red. Some have a color called Confederate Gray. Some have a color called Confederate Blue as well. But red and gray are the two. No one gives it a second thought. It's like, well, it's gray. Sure, we know what Confederate gray looks like. My point is that that's the degree to which we sort of accept this notion of the Confederacy as a society is nobody's out there protesting at the Ben Moore store. Nobody in Cleveland is going to the Sherwin-Williams factory and demanding to know why there's a color with the Confederacy's name on it. And so even the little things like that are strikingly out there. And I think they've become politicized, even embraced, in more recent years.
Might there be a way beyond this? Can we get to a point where history itself is once again, I don't want to say depoliticized, but less contentious?
That's a great question. I'm glad you asked. I wish I had a great answer for it. I will say this, that I think it's, in general, I think it's okay if history is contentious. It's okay if we're debating it. It's okay if we're talking about it. And it's okay if we disagree on it. Ultimately, it is about an interpretation, and an interpretation that is based on our particular time and place. and values at that moment and our experiences at that moment. Debating it is not a problem. Taking it seriously is not a problem. Perhaps what we need to do is think of history rather than a political statement, to think of it as one of any number of interpretations that is based on fact that we can substantiate and support. Those who say, well, we've ignored the heroic version of history. Great men, great heroes. Well, perhaps. But they may not be all that heroic. I think that it's okay to say George Washington is a great leader. It's also okay to condemn George Washington as one who enslaves people. And in the case of Washington, he doesn't just enslave people, but I mean, that slave society is about as central to his everyday life as you can get. His fabled false teeth, you know, the ones you can see at Mount Vernon, there are the teeth of, I think, 9 enslaved people in there. 7 of them are his own slaves. Here's how much that's part of his everyday life. This guy can't eat without slavery, one could argue. By talking about that, we're not saying George Washington is not a great leader. We're not saying George Washington is not a great man. I think that the mistake comes when we start looking at history and saying there is a historical narrative that is infallible and heroic. And some things are heroic, but it's not infallible, and none of them are. And I think that's the contentiousness of it, is every now and again someone will try to catch you, right? You know this, you're an historian as well. They will say, well, when you teach history, do you teach truth? Well, not precisely, is my answer. I teach an interpretation of the facts which I consider truthful. Having said that, I'm not in the capital T truth business. I'm in the capital I interpreting business. And I think as long as we focus on the fact that that's what we're doing and we can discuss those, and as long as we can back up what we're saying, I think we're fine. But we have to make sure we can back up what we say. And this notion of it somehow being, what's the term, counterfactual, we'd call it untrue or false, might be the easier word. I think when we start relying upon that's where we start getting into contentious problems.
Well, thank you so much. This has been very enlightening. We appreciate your time. Thank you, Dr. Smith, for being here.
Oh, I wouldn't have missed it. Thank you.
And thank you for listening, and we'll be back soon.
You can download the Thinking Aloud podcast at the Lindenwood University Digital Commons site, digitalcommons.lindenwood.edu/thinking_aloud/.